Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Our guest today is Ted Creighton, the founder of Joy of the People, an organization in Minnesota that takes a novel approach to youth soccer development. Ted's a former player, a longtime youth coach, and a soccer parent. Now he's spearheading a concept that I think will be interesting to people who care about soccer in America. And we're going to take a little step back from the dawn of the Berhalter era, the speculation on how he'll set up his midfield in the Gold Cup and all that, though we can talk about it if you want, Ted. But we're mostly going to talk about how young players get better. So, hey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Adam. Thanks for having me.
First of all, what is Joy of the People?
Joy of the People is kind of an idea. And the first thing I always have to remember is I'm kind of the spearheaded guy, but there's a lot of people behind me. It's an idea that a group of friends had perhaps 20 years ago. As we were playing and our careers were kind of winding down and we're in the adult leagues and starting to get into coaching, we thought, God, soccer is just taking a trip towards Americanized as a sport. And it's not really the way we see it. And we saw it more as a community sport, but the community was the pathway to expertise. There's a group of us that we get together and it's like, that's all we talk about is development. That's just all we talk about it everywhere. And we thought, hey, free play, this idea of like street basketball, pond hockey is really missing. And could we institute that into our current club? We tried. We couldn't pull people around. So then we said, hey, let's see if we can form our own nonprofit. At the time, St. Paul was kind of going through this fiscal crisis, and they had these wonderful rec centers that they couldn't keep running. And we had already gotten one for our club. And we thought, God, you know, it would be really fun if we could do our own thing. So we pitched the city to see if we could get a rec center where we could create kind of our vision of a ground zero for free play soccer. And we pitched them in 2009. And then one day in 2010, they just one day said, okay, it's yours. And they handed over the keys, and we didn't even have a name. We had nothing. We didn't know what we were going to do. We had this beautiful rec center gym. It was at the end of the fall, so we were kind of going into winter. And we had no kids. And we had a board meeting. We formed a nonprofit, and we called the nonprofit Joy of the People, after Garrincha, who was so much fun to watch that people called him Alegria de Povo, Joy of the People. And we thought, that's just a cool name. It kind of represents what we're going to do. And we set out to sort of create the free play kind of laboratory. And that's kind of what, you know, how it started. So what it is it's a nonprofit whose mission is to use unstructured play, free play. We use soccer, but you could use any sport to support the child's emotional, social, and physical health and well-being. And we think that's very important. And as a soccer coach, I've kind of seen and watched it grow into its importance for player development.
So what does that mean on a typical weekday? I mean, what's happening at the rec center like today?
Well, yeah, so we have we look at soccer as a pyramid. Generally, people use pyramids as kind of overdone, but the way we explain it to parents is, look, the competition part is important, the top of the pyramid, and the training part is also important, the middle part of the pyramid, but the foundation of the pyramid, this giant 50% of your sports experience needs to be unstructured play. So we try to set up our daily program in that way. So we'll have free play from 3 till 6 today. And then at 6 o'clock, we have a little 5 to 8 program where we it's a pay for program, not very expensive, where 5 to 8 year olds come in and we present an hour program for them, which uses a lot of things that we learn from free play including the science-backed stuff that everybody's talking about today, like differential learning and nonlinear pedagogy. And so we use all those things that we know, and we just use that for the kids. We allow parents to play with their kids if the kids are uncomfortable. You know, some 5-6-year-olds are really more attached to their parents. And we just, you know, we bring on inflatables, we put music on, we have lots of different balls and sizes, and just it's a really cool programming hour. And that programming helps pay for the free play time that we give away before it.
The free play before it is free to anybody.
Correct. Free to anybody. All we ask for is a waiver. We get kids from all clubs, areas, teams, parents coming, checking out, kids of all ages. And we generally have places for kids of all ages to participate. Then at 6 o'clock, we have an all-girls program today. And what's interesting about that is when you have free play, in the United States, the girls, you could say, certainly in Minnesota, the girls program is stronger, bigger than, especially in the suburbs, than the boys programs. Hmm. There's more, most of the high level coaches are coaching in the girls program. There's a lot more money in youth programming because of the, the college scholarships and the Title IX. And, but when girls do free play, they don't do it in sort of the numbers that the boys do it. So we've separated out a girls only program and to help build the girls side. So tonight is girls rock. So we have younger girls and then older girls. And then I think at 8:30, there's a group that rents out our gym. And I go home and, tomorrow starts another day.
Okay. Well, so you coached at St. Paul Blackhawks soccer for a long time. You were the coaching director there. You were a purveyor of a far more traditional youth soccer experience. So how did you arrive at this idea? I mean, what prompted you?
So I was, as a player, I started playing at 16. I had to, learn everything. So I played at a pretty high level. I was with Minnesota United, or Minnesota, what were they back then? Minnesota Thunder. And I had to learn everything. And as learning everything, I always, sought out best practice. So I was very fit. I used, my diet was I was really into the science of diet, nutrition, exercise science. And I brought that to Blackhawks. Along with, in 1989, I took a trip to Brazil with my best friend. And it kind of changed my life because I spent 2 months there. And I just saw how they enjoyed soccer in a different way. A funny thing was this, 90 degree day, we were going to go to a game that night, So we decided to play out in this futsal court across from his house, and his friends were playing, and my team was losing the game 10-6 or something. And what I decided to do was just chase the ball all over the field. I'm going to get this freaking ball back because my team's losing. We're going to win this game.
All right.
And they started passing it around me saying, ole, ole. And I was getting really upset. And then that got them, they were laughing even more, which got me more upset, right? I don't remember how the game ended, but those guys that I played with and my, we still keep in touch today. They've visited Minnesota. They've come here and seen the joy of the people, and they remember those days. But they had sort of this idea that hustle, something that hustle is bad. And for an American, it's no, hustle's always good. Huh. No, you're trying too hard. Well, what's trying too hard? That's impossible. So I was coming to terms with this. They would do things we'd go spend a weekend at the C2, which is basically a Brazilian cabin. And every Brazilian cabin is the same. They have a barbecue pit. They have a sort of a fenced-in small mini court, which is usually grass with big goals. And this particular one had cinder block walls around the outside. So it's basically the size of a futsal court with grass, and people would play barefoot. Huh. And the swimming pool, small swimming pool. So you'd go from the soccer field to the swimming pool to the barbecue pit, and then soccer field, you know, just keep going around. And, you know, they were like, it was competitive. It was fun. It was light. It was relaxed. It was intense. It was all those things mixed together, the way it sort of fit into the life of their experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I thought, when I first came to Blackhawks and started that project, we brought in futsal. We were the first club to do it. We brought in the first futsal tournament. It wasn't even called futsal back then. It was called Futebol Salon. We did all the best practice trainings we could think of. We were doing the sort of Kovar-esque technical to tactical where, and we had it down. We were like, we had, and I was working in gyms, probably 8-9 years, you know, Monday through Friday, all day Saturday, you know, putting in 3-4 hours a night. So I was putting in thousands of hours. And if there's a kid in St. Paul that's become a really, you know, good soccer player or that's played soccer, they know me. Their parents know me. And it's really cool to see them grow up and have them come back to me. And so we were like pumping in all this best practice stuff into Blackhawks, and at the same time, the environment around Blackhawks, you know, started to get more competitive. They started something called the Development Academy, and a local club became a Development Academy. And, you know, and the parents of these kids that we had developed started to either one, their kids wanted to go to that Development Academy because it was, you know, perceived as a higher level, or two, they were worried about those kids on those teams that were leaving and how could we hold the team together. Mm-hmm. So the pressure became greater and greater on retention. And at that point, one of the leaders of sort of Minnesota soccer told my board, they came in, they gave a big presentation. We want your, because at the time you could certainly argue that, you know, we were the best in several age groups, not necessarily on the team level, like winning every game, but certainly on the player development level, we were like producing players that were just dynamic and just not because we were doing anything special. We were just playing more in a best practice environment. And this, they came in, all these leaders from Minnesota soccer came in and they gave a beautiful presentation on this new youth academy that's going to be called the Development Academy, which I was familiar with, that they wanted all their best kids to come to. And if I thought they were the best situation, I would have sent them in a second. But I wasn't confident that it was. And one of those leaders said to our board, either you give us your kids or we're going to take them from you. Those were his words. The one of our smart board members said, okay, you guys, tell me how you grew up. And they said, we used to, you know, we grew up in the neighborhood. We'd call each other up. We'd go play at the park. We were like, you know, we play every day and like, and, you know, we play in our backyard. We made goals out of the basketball nets. And we, and this board member said very eloquently, he said, wow, you know, you guys want our kids to come to your, you know, sort of structured model, but it sounds like you guys who all played at a very high level, grew up under our model of just play close to home, which we were kind of instilling at Blackhawks at the time. But the pressure on the board got too much. And so when we wanted to do free play, they were like, you know, free play is great, but we got to do, what about these tournaments and leagues and, you know, how do we keep this team together? And so it became too difficult to develop kids any longer. And I also felt like even though the kids that we were developing were great, there was something missing at the top end. And I wanted to try to figure that out. Hmm. So that's kind of why we started JOTP.
Now you've told me a story about an impromptu tournament that you took some kids to that was kind of eye-opening for you. What, you like spray painted some jerseys the night before?
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah, it's a great story. And I've even told this story, like, and I like tear up when I talk about it sometimes, because when we started Joy of the People, I handed over the schedule to my best friend who was the president. He's the president. And I said, here's the schedule. And he like, He was all, he looked upset. I go, what's the matter? He goes, well, where's the free play? I said, well, it's there, 7:30 a.m. in the morning, 11. He goes, you're hiding it. And of course I was hiding it. I said, Victor, free play's there, but I can coach better than free play can deliver. And he said, that might be the case, but we're about free play. You have to dedicate yourself to it. Not only that, but you have to hold yourself to it. No coaching, no interaction. You know, if you do give feedback to the kids, it's got to be, you must be a player on the field and not a coach itself. So we created these rules of free play. And my own kid was involved, and he wasn't that interested in soccer. He was sort of a little bit of a goofball, and maybe and very like eclectic. He liked a lot of things, and he loved being with kids. He loved his friends, but he wasn't into sort of what we were doing at, you know, if I had stayed with Blackhawks, he would never have, the year after I left, they started to create tiered teams at U9 or 10, which would have been his age group. He would have never made that ever. And people would come down and pat me on the shoulder and say, sorry about your kid, because he's out there picking dandelions. And, and you know, and you want to have faith that your kid's going to enjoy the game. But basically what you want is you want your son or daughter to just enjoy soccer. Not, there's no need for them to play at a high level or be the greatest. Just to see them enjoying with smiles on their faces. And he was doing that, but I didn't feel like it was the most great environment. So when we started here, we started free play, just a couple of kids, and he was one of them. And we have some video from back then. It's just hilarious. One is we had to make some videos of the kids. So it's my daughter and my son and his best friend. So the idea was, let's make a cute video and let's, you know, use this to market kids coming to Joy of the People. So the video is my daughter, who is probably about 4 or 5. She's got like a tooth missing. And she goes, hello, my name is Dare. And we're going to do along with me. It's just, she's really good talker. She's really just, she still talks all the time. She goes, along with me, I have a couple of friends, Zinedine, my brother Zinedine, and his best friend, Brett. And what we're going to do is we're going to hula hoop and do some soccer tricks. So they were hula hooping and running with the soccer ball and doing little moves and stuff. So it's a really cute video, except at the end of the video, Zinedine just cranks a shot, hits me in the head. So the camera shakes and, you know, I'm like, oh, you guys are doing so good. And he hits me in the camera and I start beep, beep. But we added a few more, and these kids, we had about 10 kids that got a call to enter this tournament. And I went to the kids and they're like goofing around in the gym, of course, like they always were. And I said, hey, we have a chance to enter this tournament. They need a team and we'd have to play at U11. You want to do it?
And I think go ahead.
It's a futsal tournament. So it was a little mini futsal tournament in Prior Lake. And so they're like, yeah, let's do it, you know, and we need jerseys. And so we quickly YouTubed how to make spray painted jerseys, and we bought some stuff and we spray painted them in the rubber room of our, and that night we were driving home. My son goes, Dad, you finally came through, you know, because now they had jerseys that they were going to wear, and they'd been playing. So this was probably in March. So they've been playing 3 months of just free play with very little instruction, just getting together after school, about 5 days a week. And my wife called me while they're playing in the tournament because I was coaching. And she said, Ted, you won't believe what's happening. I go, what? Are they getting killed? No, they won like 14-13. And she goes, they just score. And then they just let the other team score. And then they get the ball and they run down and score again. And then they let the other team score and they run down. And so when I finished coaching, I went over there and watched it. And I could see these kids just in, and I was blown away. I was like, they don't play like this in the gym. What are they doing? They were just, you could just see the learning. And I knew that the learning that was happening, I could see from my background of spending all those hours in gymnasiums, kind of, you know, technically teaching kids the things that they were getting from technical approach and the things that they were getting from the free play. And I knew personally what I'd given these kids, and I'd kind of stayed away from the technical approach, that these kids were doing things in a way that was very, very different. They ended up winning that tournament. They
What were they doing different? How are they different from the players they were playing against?
They play with smiles on their faces. They seem to associate soccer with joy, with putting on a show. As soon as an example I use a lot, which is kind of like opened my eyes, was in soccer, you tend to teach something called first attacker, first defender, and you use a lot of 1v1s. And the first attacker is, you know, taking guys on and trying to get past the defender, opening yourself up for a shot or dribble. And first defender is how you stop that. And generally, you teach it fairly early. You get in there and you get down low and you get close to the ball, try to get the attacker, get his head down. Our kids and the other team that we were playing was a more traditional, they were this sort of, you know, elite club. They had all their soccer bags lined up. They showed up in uniforms. I could see our kids kind of like, oh my God, look at those uniforms, you know? Our kids did not have first defender. They had something called what I would call zero defender, where the defender had the ball and they just run right up to the ball and right through them if they had to. They were just going to get that ball back. And it came from free play. So when when the other team had the ball in free play, just like, I want it, I'm going to go get it. And so without any knowledge of how, the proper way to do a first or second defender, they just went up and tried to get the ball. Now, of course, they made mistakes. You know, the easiest thing to do is go around someone who's flying at you.
Right.
But sometimes they would follow them. And then sometimes they would do something where they would like stick their toe out, knock the ball behind the attacker, run around, get it, and they'd be behind the attacker. And they were, if you've ever played kids who grew up in Brazil or Mexico or street style Africa, they know how to dispossess you of the ball when it's very close, when it's like a knife fight.
Right.
They're very good pressuring you up close because they've done it a lot. And that is what I saw was, oh, that's coming from free play. If I would have taught those kids first defender, they would have lost the chance to learn this sort of close in defending, which most American kids don't do and can't do. But our kids can. Mm-hmm. And the reason our kids can is not because they're special, is because the coach didn't step in and teach a first defender. So that made me very apprehensive about the coaching I was giving to kids. What other mistakes was I possibly making? You know, we felt that the best players had put in all these hours in free play as kids. And at the same time, they were rising to the high level. So the two were kind of going together. But what was it about those free play hours that was able to help elevate those kids? We didn't know. And we still don't know all the answers, but we do know that we saw that day that, wow, there's real power in letting kids learn from themselves. Now, of course, today we have our 19-year-old futsal team is going to go play for the national title in 2 weeks. They defend really, really well. They don't overdive in. They can defend close. They can defend, you know, those tactical things came much later and slower than other groups, but they also have the skills that they learn in free play, sort of the freedom of how to beat people, how to take people on, how to dribble, get themselves out of trouble through dribble and passing and movement. And those things came by just being patient and letting them learn.
So where does coaching come into this? Maybe this is the controversial part, yeah. But like at what age?
It is. And I think if you, So we have like a model. We have this model that we put together where on one end of the continuum you'd have free play, and the other end of the continuum you'd have deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is kind of what Erickson and others, you know, the 10,000 hours of this hard, deliberate, hard, difficult, not inherently fun workouts that we all know about, we all have been through, and we don't necessarily like them, but we know it drives us to be better. And sort of like when I was in Brazil running around in that sort of hustle play, I was like using deliberate practice. I'm just going to work these guys into the very, and they were playing with me. So you can use both approaches to get to the highest level. So play comes in early. And so our model says lots of play as kids, and then deliberate practice comes much later. And coaching at a young age comes in sort of a fatherly or big brother way, where we allow the kids, we act as the oldest kid at the park, and we say, what are we going to do today? You know, what do you guys want to do? How can we make teams? So it's more play, and they kind of set the rules. We'd use things like subtle things like the different ball to equalize, or different goal sizes to create more goal scoring chances, or different size fields to create overload in possession or dribble opportunities. The coaching comes in more of a sort of a non-seeing way, but not in a feedback, not in a praise way, but sort of just overall nurturing the kids. Because if you give too much feedback, you don't want the kids to be thinking about their learning. So we want kids to fly. We want kids to take off. We want kids to, right? But in order to do that, you sort of need a framework. And we had this idea of deliberate free play early and deliberate practice late, but there was no examples in the real world that we could use. We thought there would be free play centers all over the world in many different sports. There are sort of free play spaces, but people don't really understand them or have used them within the curriculum. So the model that we kind of came up on was, he was a linguist that I had at when I went to school at USC, and his name is Stephen Krashen, and a lot of people now are looking at soccer more like a language than they are sort of a motor sport acquisition thing. So people like Raymond Verheyen are saying, hey, it's communication, decision-making, execution and fitness are the least important. If it's communication, then can we look at it as a language? And if it's a language, should we be looking at Chomsky, the greatest linguists and theorists of language learning theory, Chomsky and Krashen? And Krashen has, nobody really knows how you learn a first language, but so they looked at second language. How do some people have a second language and speak it fluently? And how do others learn a second language, but they always, you know, it's not perfect and they have to work hard at it. In soccer, I was the second language of soccer guy.
Yeah.
I don't believe I was ever fluent. I played at a very high level only because I deliberate practice, you know, to the nth degree. And I think people who played with me would agree with that. I could disguise it and look like it, but I could never be like my best friend who kind of grew up in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So in order to learn a language fluently, we have to go through a period which is called acquisition, where we're not thinking about the learning of the language. So there's your feedback thing. There's no rewards. It's all about the joy of the language and the comprehensible input. It's about the input, like what's going into the brain, not what's coming out. Not how good the kid can kick the ball, but what's coming in. So we started to see that first period of time, the play period, as an input period. What good things can we help put into their brain? So we use best practice of a fast surface of the ball moves quickly, futsal and football, so long balls, where the ball is dead. So the person has to make an immediate decision. They don't spend any time controlling the ball. Mm-hmm. Their decision-making, it's a decision-making machine. Bigger goals, so that they have to think about different goal scoring, problem solving. Equalize balls, so they can't just boom the ball in against a goalie. They have to sort of figure out how to finish, go put the ball in slowly, easily. Mm-hmm. So the acquisition period is sort of like it's sort of like the Situ in Brazil, where it was just all about the love of together, being together and playing together. And that's what we try to do up to a certain period. And when kids go from acquisition to deliberate practice, they go from a boy to a man. And it's almost like overnight something switches in their brain. And they stop really enjoying that Situ as stuff as much, and they want to go take on the best. And it's a cool thing to see, but in the brain of the player, it's kind of difficult, because we would like the acquisition to go as long as possible. So if you stop your acquisition too soon, you don't have this sort of big bank of knowledge that you can take forward. So we want, if we were going to make a mistake, it would be in making a mistake of letting the acquisition go as long as possible. We feel, and we've had many arguments about this, that I feel that it's at peak height velocity, which is sort of this scientific moment where the prefrontal cortex closes, the kid, all of a sudden something goes off in their brain and they just say, I don't want to play with little kids anymore. I want to go play with the big kids. I want to take on the best. 15, 16, 14, somewhere around there. So we try to inch in deliberate practice around 14 years of age for those kids that are that age. And then the 19-year-olds and stuff, they just want to play adults. They want to be shown tactical movement patterns. They want to, they basically want to take on the best. They want to know what's out there in the world. And we've given them, that's the foundation of acquisition. And we believe that gives them a lot of things to say to the outside world, a lot of possibilities. And as I look at sort of the traditional model of growing kids, and I've visited academies all over the world and studied all over the world, is we're kind of all doing the same thing, which is deliberately practicing young kids. And then, as sometimes as young as 6, 7, 8, giving them too much feedback, dressing them up in uniforms, parading them out in front of 30,000 people and telling them at 12, announcing to the stadium that this is our future, is very difficult for those kids to continue to develop. The community, the beauty of this acquisition period is you can't do it to get better. You can only do it because it's fun. So a lot of times the acquisition period is in a battle with this sort of idea that you must get better and performance matters and you rank against the next kid. And when kids move out of that acquisition phase too soon, because they've either been exposed to this elite level or people have told them you have to start playing at a higher level, we've seen those kids go. But interestingly, those kids have not rocketed it off in the development phase. They've sort of, plateaued, I would say. And I don't really want to get too much into that, but I guess I would say that what we really believe in, what we believe in, and we don't have all the answers, but we're really searching.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting at a very much a minimum. Is your hope that what you're creating in that rec center, it's right at the border of Minneapolis and St. Paul, for those of you not from here. What you're creating there is something akin to the Brazilian Situ or the I guess the Parisian suburbs, which doesn't really exist in the U.S., right?
Yeah, if you look at those Paris suburbs. I mean, that was that's the secret to their World Cup success. And it's also, unless Brazil discovers it back again, it's going to be, they're not going to hold court any longer. Yeah, we want to sort of create free play as the best practice model. And we would like to help other clubs and organizations understand how better to build this sort of, you know, we've gone to them, we've gone to many clubs and organizations, including U.S. Soccer and U.S. Club Soccer, and talked to the leaders, and everybody is really interested. But the question is, you know, what is the how? How are we going to do that? But basically, if you look at any club, they have their competition, then they have their training, but we can help build a basement underneath. And we bring these ideas of sort of how to keep this community of play together. But what's interesting is this play period can't be at the battle or the service of the elite level. And I think one of my goals is to see this kind of grow as sort of a let people know that you don't need, despite what people are saying, in spite of this FOMO, in many ways you would be better off by not joining your local travel club, by setting up a game in your backyard, by following some simple best practices, by nurturing community play. And what you would see is those kids, because they're kind of doing it on their own, would avoid the traps of things like lack of humility, of sort of, and they would gain the sort of huge social skills. And play really is a, it was chosen by evolution as the method for expertise. Polar bears play at wrestling so they can, you know, beat their competition later. It's just been chosen. And we have to sort of invest resources into it, into building more of these community spaces and small communities, mini communities, micro clubs that just allow kids to grow for a very long time. When Brazil dominated the world, when they were like the best, like nobody could come close to them, is when they had wonderful free play sections throughout their cities. Mm-hmm. And they didn't bother with getting academies until 16 years old, when they would basically open up. That's when Zagallo went to America. So those kids had 15, 16 years of acquisition. Ronaldo Fenomeno, he was invited to an academy but didn't like the three-hour bus ride. So he said, I'm just going to play with my friends. And when he went back, he was better than all those kids at the academy at 16. Mm. So we would like to sort of see this idea of like, hey, what cool community groups can we create all over the United States that just grow kids and let them play? And not only do they create great soccer skills, but conflict resolution, resolution, decision-making, communication, leadership, all these things are integral into, they make mistakes, of course, but they learn in a great way through this play.
Well, some of the things that are really interesting to me about all this is that so much of soccer is winning those individual battles, those knife fights, you know, in close quarters that you were talking about, but then also solving problems with your brain, and then solving problems with your brain in relation to your teammates. And mm-hmm. I wonder, like, do you really think that free play equips kids to do those things better than, you know, highly structured coaching environment from mm-hmm. the age? Is 8 when kids are starting to mm-hmm. get really involved in that these days? I don't know. My kids are very young.
I mean, you can, I mean, this is the ongoing argument. I don't want to step into like a giant argument, but what I would say is, when we teach tactics, we move. So traditionally, you have to divide up the idea of cognitive decision making with personal decision making and sort of group tactical decision making. In other words, a lot of people define it, I don't, as technique, how you move the ball, and tactics, how you move the people on the field. So you can get put a lot of resources into a very, we play futsal teams at 11, 12 years old that are very tactically organized, and that's where they put their resources. And if you play futsal or even outdoor teams that are very tactically organized, but it's much more difficult to tactically organize 7, 9, or 11 players. But what I would say is when kids do free play, they sort of follow this sort of organic procession, I would say, of development, which is first build a strong me, and then, so it's all about input. What am I taking in? Then you start to communicate with others. First, you're communicating, you know, when you first grow up, you're communicating with your dad or mom in goal. You know, I'm going to score on you, mom. You know, that's, you know, and how it's communicating is, mom, I'm going to make you think I'm going to pass here, but I'm going to shoot it over there. It wasn't that fun. And you start, that's how you learn the sort of communication and how to move players. So you're basically moving the goalie out of the way by faking one side. You're moving the goalie with just your brain by opening up your body, and the goalie's moving to that side and you shoot to the other side. Kind of the first step. And then when the defenders come in front of you, communicating with the defender, how do I move you to the left so I can go straight to the goal? And then you start to communicate. The next step is, okay, well, they got three defenders on me. How do I communicate with my best friend on my team over here? He's pushing up to the outside. I'm going to pass him a ball. Oh, if I pass the ball in front of him, he'll receive with his front foot and it's faster to the goal. The complex tactical things that people are teaching at very high levels of positional play and things like that, even a great Greg Berhalter-esque systems, are born in free play. And those concepts are not only born in free play, but their science will tell you they're in their brains in a better way, because now it's unconscious rather than Greg Berhalter. Is that how you say it?
No K, just Berhalter.
Berhalter. If he tells you to receive the ball on your front foot, you're thinking, what would Greg do at this point? Open up, which is, you know, system two thinking, which is slower. It's conscious based. You'll see kids here at Joy of the People receive the ball on their front foot all the time. Not because any coach told them what to do, because they figured out it's freaking easier for me to go to goal because I want to score a goal faster if I take it off that foot. But sometimes it's not the right answer. Nuno Gomez took the ball off his right foot, off his back foot, when he scored against England in 2002 Euros. And that was the goal that sent England out of the Euros. So if Nuno had been taught only on the front foot, he probably wouldn't have scored that goal. But he improvised. So, and that was unconscious. So when kids learn through free play, they learn in an unconscious way. And even if you look at the vibrant courts of Paris, there's a lot of older players playing there, 16, 17, 18, 19, a lot of men playing. So now you have sort of an even higher level, and you can't tell me they're just free-balling at that court. The people ruling that court are figuring out, you know, tactical movements, and everything comes from free play, whether it's positional play, whether it's moves, whether it's different ways of scoring, whether it's it all comes from free play. It all comes from the park first, and then somebody sort of figures it out, sees it, puts it into some kind of framework. Usually these days it starts in futsal, and then you'll see it a few years later in soccer. Things like rotations, which are now being used in soccer, start in futsal. But before futsal, somebody developed it in free play. That's my thought about that.
Okay. Well, I imagine you've alluded to it, but you've probably met some resistance with these ideas. How do you persuade people that it's a good idea not to coach kids, not to really coach kids until they're 14, at least?
That's the question. Every day I talk about it. every single day. You know, every single day, parents would come in, you know, this is great, but my daughter could use a little extra of this or that.
So you have to say, no, she couldn't use a little extra this or that. She just needs to.
You're my new spokesperson. You could come in and just say that over and over. You try to convince them, you show them, look, this is what she's interested in now. She's interested in beating people. She's not, you notice when she loses the ball, she's not chasing it back. She's not helping on a defense, but that's because that's what she's interested in and exploring. And it's almost like their brains can only handle so much. And you can look at, with every player, you can look at their, find some faults. And I always tell kids, look, just do what you love to do and be great at that. And I guess when parents see their kids enjoying it so much, that's the light bulb moment for the kid, for the parent. They don't get it. Then they see the step two is they see their kid playing it, doing things they never thought they'd see. And I think for the kids, it's difficult, I think, sometimes for the kids who enjoy the people who, because we, you know, in comparison to around us, our kids are playing more freely and organic and a lot, probably more hours. They can compare themselves against somebody else and then see, wow, I'm doing really well. And there's a lot of pressure sometimes on kids getting recruited away and people telling them, hey, you got to stop this goofy stuff and you got to start playing more serious soccer. But I guess... You look at the successful models of the kids who've kind of gone on and done very well in high school, very well in college now, you know, and other things that have been sort of, those are the kids that kind of stuck with it. And there's a lot of those kids and, you know, you just kind of use them as an example.
I should have asked you this earlier, but about how many kids participate at Joy of the People in a typical week?
So a typical week, like last week we were, it was, you know, what, 40 below for 3 days in a row. So the schools were closed.
Yeah, I remember that.
Just opened up. We opened it up and we say, anybody wants to come can come. So we had over 250 kids over those 3 days. We get about, in a week, we get about 300 kids between the two locations. Signed up full time for us, added to that would be about 125 full-time kids who come just basically every day of the year. And then like in the summer, I think our best program is summer camp where they basically just spend all day here and they'll play on a bouncy inflatable court. They'll play soccer, tennis on the tennis court. They'll play in the gym. They'll watch the Women's World Cup. They'll eat lunch here. They'll go back outside. They'll play some, we built a new little, not little, it's a $300,000 field for the city of St. Paul, which is a mini field with extremely cool technology that's very green, including cork infill. And it's just for kids to play, just another engine of cool, you know, so when people see that field, they're like, I want to play there. You know, it varies from week to week. About 3,000 kids a year come through the doors.
Wow. That's bigger than I would have guessed.
Yeah, it's a lot of kids, yeah.
And I feel like when I see you on Twitter, you know, you tweet every now and then, and just talking to you now and the last time we talked, a lot of what you're saying about soccer development seems like it's also applicable to parenting in general, you know? And I wonder if you see it that way.
Oh, heck yeah. The best thing any soccer player can have is like a solid parent. You know, that's the best. I mean, that's the right of every kid is a parent who says, please quit soccer now and focus on your schoolwork. I'm just joking with that. But basically, it's like, let's get our priorities in order. The best things that we've seen here are the parents who offer no plan B for their kids. And by that I mean, hey, you're all in, enjoy the people. You know, we're all in, you know, you know, if you have problems, you take it to Ted, you take it to Andre. But that's where you're going to be. So the kid has no choice, no plan B. He just comes, he plays every day, keeps his head down, and he just keeps getting, works with the younger kids, plays with little kids, turns into a great leader that then goes on to lead his school and, you know, goes on in life and hopefully one day drives past here and says, kids, that's where I played when I was a kid. I'm so proud of that place. You know, that's where I think parenting is the most difficult thing in youth sports today by far. And we all need to come to Jesus model where we just say, we're throwing money at things to put so much pressure on kids. And if I could, and we have some ideas on how to get rid of the pay-to-play model, but free play is the closest thing out there to one, best practice, two, a healthy environment for kids, and three, inexpensive, or because it's free, soccer sport out there. It could work in all sports. But basically, our biggest thing, and is how to onboard and sort of educate parents to sort of create a really, you know, beautiful pathway for their kids in their childhood.
Yeah, I guess I'm also thinking about this, just the idea of letting kids explore something and enjoy something could also be applied to. Basically everything. I have a 3-year-old and a 1.5-year-old at home, and I'm always, I have to really stop myself from over intervening all the time.
So, yeah, I mean, Adam, I think a few years ago when we realized, so we went searching for free play models everywhere. We went to Brazil and we talked to all the greats and they said, yeah, I grew up on, wow. We're like, this is really, soccer is really informing us about life. That as kids, we should just be exploring and creating community where without community, there's no greatness. All right. You can't. And if you have that community, and you pluck out all the great kids at a certain age, you will shrink the community. So they kind of go in together. The example is, the outdoor hockey rinks of St. Paul, Minneapolis are all empty, all of them. Because one by one, those kids were plucked out, including my own park where I lived. And pretty soon it just shrunk away. Everybody joined the indoor ice rinks. So community is really important, and resources need to be invested in that. And that community will deliver the elite players and those elite players understand community. And we saw this thing as so I'm supposed to be writing a book, but this is an educational model. This is like free play as kids, deliver practice later. This is not just soccer. This is also when NASA was having trouble with crash, they had difficulty for 10, 15 years. They brought in consultants and the consultants said, your problem is your hiring practices. And NASA said, well, we're hiring the best at MIT and these other places, Jet Propulsion Labs. They said, no, when in the 60s, those engineers who put the man on the moon, those were people who, as kids, they worked on their farm and worked on the tractor, or they worked in the dad's ham radio. They enjoyed playing at engineering, and then later they applied it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really a model that people are, the science is now backing it up. And if you look at things like Project Play at the Aspen Institute, people are seeing that play is really, really important, and that the things that we're learning at Joy of the People are applicable not just for soccer. certainly for other sports. We're introducing a hockey Joy of the People this summer, but also also in education, in math and reading. The only interesting fields that have kind of figured this out are video games, who, you know what I mean? They like slowly acquire people and then they get them real serious later. And they do a good job of it, unfortunately.
Well, okay. Well, before we wrap up here, back to soccer a little bit more. Your son, Zinedine, and another player whose name I can't remember who came up.
Emmanuel.
Okay. Came up through Joy of the People, both trialed at Werder Bremen in October, was it, or September?
November.
Okay. Tell us about that. How did that come about?
It kind of caught us as a surprise. I have a friend in Chicago, and I was showing them videos of and telling them about, hey, why aren't you doing free play? And these kids are different. And I brought him down to play in a guest tournament. And he said, wow, I wasn't expecting that. Let me call a few people. And a number of clubs were interested. Werder Bremen was the first one to do it. And he said, don't play the clubs against each other. So they wanted us to come down in September. We couldn't because of high school league rules. And so we went in November. I went with Victor and Glenn, came for a couple of days. It was very interesting. I think they did very, very well. It was a really cool club. You know, they met Josh Sargent and Isaiah Young, who are also there.
Yep.
And they had a great time. They fit right in. Probably where they're a little bit behind was physical. I mean, they were trying out with the 23s and they're only 18. When they play with the 19s, they both scored. They did very well. I think if you ask them both, they want to be professionals. Emmanuel's going back soon to a different club, and there's some other opportunities for Z. And so they're going to probably – they want to – finish. So Emmanuel moved back up here so after the whole experience, Emmanuel goes, I just want to be around Joy of the People so that I can train every day and be ready for my next trial in Germany. But what's interesting is when we train, we just play with little kids. We just play. It's like a – And so,
yeah. It's so counterintuitive.
Yeah. And so, but he's already, you can see him picking up. It was really, I think, eye-opening for them and fun. They were tossed into a heavy, periodized training schedule that was very constrained and compact and meant to train those 223s, the second team, for the first team, and also for their game on the weekend. So if you know anything about periodization for those kids, young kids, to be thrown into that, you know, they were just exhausted. They were just so tired. They had they were there for 2 weeks. Very positive comments from them. They want to see them back. But again, they have other opportunities as well. So they look forward to the day when they can do something like that again, I think.
Well, keep us posted.
We'll do.
Please. I think a lot of people will say, yeah, this is great. You've gotten some good results with players. I mean, surely if Zinedine or Emmanuel or both end up, getting a contract with a European club, that's a pretty big feather in your cap, but is it sustainable or scalable? Mm. You're there a lot of the days.
Yeah. I know. So, I heard you ask that question to Gary Cleveland and,
Brian,
who kind of is like, I love his work and he's on the other end of the spectrum. You know, we're both kind of doing it from different ways. It's gotta be scalable. We have to figure it out. We work on it every day. The world is changing, in many ways. It's important for all kids. We've scaled it a little bit in that we have like another program, and we've done a couple of pilot programs at different soccer clubs that have been successful. So we're looking at, keep looking at ways of how to, you know, package this idea for people either to give it away or to one day win the World Cup with Free Play Kids.
All right. What's sort of the next step there? You're gonna license some ideas and sell mm-hmm. them to sell them to youth clubs, or
yeah, we're gonna make $1 million. $1 million off of Free Play. We're gonna monetize Free Play.
I don't know. Yeah,
we're gonna weaponize it. I think what we're working on is some cool things using technology to sort of allow people to easily provide best practice Free Play in a confident way with their neighborhood kids. I think Free Play has died, for instance, for hockey, but 70% of the NHL players grew up within 2 blocks of a backyard rink.
Yeah.
So the backyard rink serves these days as the new Free Play center for NHL hockey. And kids will, no matter what, Free Play will still be delivering kids, whether it's the beautiful play of Hispanic or African communities, they'll still be producing those kids. So what we have to do is figure out how to do that more. So we have some, I think, you know, we want to get our ideas out there. I'm writing a book on this sort of education model. I've been invited to a couple speaking engagements. So we're just continuing to work on the sort of growth of the idea of Joy of the People and at the same time, continuing our work that we do with these kids that come through our program.
All right. Well, Ted, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate
it. I really enjoyed it, Adam.
Yeah, I'll be sending my kids up your way if they want me to when they get a little bit older.
Once they get here, they have to be the ones driving it. So then you'll be like, God damn, dang nab, Joy of the People. You know, I got to drive my kid over there again.
Gladly do it. Gladly do it. Good luck to you. Thanks again. Really appreciate it. All right.